Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Our kitchen looked out into the backyard, and that's where me and my brothers and my friends would always hang out. And so, you know, you're playing with your friends. And my mom, she'd walk out on the porch, "Mark, time to come home," or, "Mark, Brian, and Jeff, come on, let's go. It's dinner time." Stuff, you know, that seems stereotypical for the period, but is just really, really cool when you think about it.
Welcome to Your Mama's Kitchen, the podcast that explores how the kitchens and culinary traditions of our youth shape who we become as adults. I'm Michelle Norris, and my guest today is Mark Cuban, businessman, film producer, investor, and until recently, the majority stakeholder in the Dallas Mavericks NBA team. You may be familiar with him as a fixture on Shark Tank, one of America's most popular reality TV shows, where Mark Cuban has invested in dozens of successful startups. He's the entrepreneur behind innovative companies like Mark Cuban Cost Plus Drugs that seeks to shake up the industry by offering deep discounts on prescription drugs to people who lack insurance or can't otherwise afford them. Mark prides himself on being a man who sees opportunities where others might see walls. Like the team he once owned, he's a maverick himself, looking for new paths and new ways of approaching the marketplace to solve problems and sometimes improve people's lives. He comes from a family of Eastern European Jewish refugees. They arrived in America with almost nothing, but they had an abundance of optimism and a do-what-needs-to-be-done work ethic that rubbed off on Mark. And as you will hear in this episode, the other message Mark got from his mama was to never be afraid to shake up the system. From his earliest days growing up in Pittsburgh, Mark has been a rabble-rouser and a bit of an outsider. But that attitude helped him get inside some pretty important spaces. He's now worth billions. But he says the things he treasures most are the family values he absorbed as a kid, surrounded by parents and grandparents who were dreamers and strivers. In this episode, we dig into how Mark got his start in business, selling garbage bags door to door as a 12-year-old entrepreneur. You heard that right. He was selling garbage bags and he made a handsome profit. We'll also hear about Mark's mother's culinary journey into macrobiotics, not Mark's favorite period, so he prefers to remember her kitchen by something a little sweeter, noodle raisin kugel. It was so good that he fought his little brothers to get the corners where the sugar and cinnamon would crisp up. It's a dish that still appears in his kitchen today, though we hope for his family's sake that he's gotten a little better at sharing it. That's coming up. Stay tuned. Mark Cuban, thank you very much for joining us. I have been looking forward to this.
Me too. Thanks for having me.
This is a podcast, as you know, where we talk about food, we talk about identity, we tell origin stories. You grew up in Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh, PA. Yes, I did.
You're a Texan now, but by birth, you're from Pennsylvania. Can you tell me a little bit about the Pittsburgh that you grew up in and the neighborhood you grew up in, and then take me inside the house that you grew up in?
Oh, my goodness. So I was born in Squirrel Hill, which is, at that point in time, the Jewish part of town, on Hobart Street. And it was a small apartment that I know of from pictures. And it's my earliest memories of going to preschool and my mom walking me there. And then my dad did upholstery on cars. And so he worked on West Liberty Avenue, and that's where he really started his career. And we lived there probably till I was 5 years old. And then my dad wanted to move to the quote-unquote suburbs, as he tells it to me. And so then we moved to Birdland, which is in the South Hills of Pittsburgh. And I went from being a Jewish part of town to being one of two Jews in the whole area. So from there, we lived on Metal Ark Drive, 1134 Metal Ark Drive. And that's really where I grew up, where I found my love for sports, met lifelong friends, went to Samuel S. Nixon Elementary School, you name it. That's my story up until I'm about 12 years old.
And then what happened when you were 12?
When we're 12, we moved less than a mile away to the good school district, Mount Lebanon. So I moved from Metal Ark Drive to Bower Hill Road, 1223 Bower Hill Road, and moved from John Dewey Junior High, which was one of the nastiest places you could ever possibly go to school, to Jefferson Junior High, which was, relatively speaking, much nicer place to go to school, which put me on a path to go to Mount Lebanon High School.
And high school known around the world, very good high school.
Yeah, it is a good high school, yeah. And that's what my dad would tell me, you know, the place we could afford in the nicest school district we can get into.
Yeah, I recognize that my parents did the same thing, bought the best house they could in the best school district.
Yep.
I think that was an aspirational wish for parents of our generation. So we normally begin this podcast with a simple question, but we dove into your background because I wanted to know a little bit about the Pittsburgh that you remember. And I always ask the simple question, tell me about your mama's kitchen. But you have lived in so many different houses and so many different neighborhoods. When I ask that question, where does your mind go?
Probably both houses on Bower Hill Road and in Birdland, where they're just small kitchens. There was nothing busy or exciting or fancy about them. It was just the smell and the meals and the competition between my brothers to get to dessert first.
And I think could eat fastest?
Right, yeah, because we're all big guys. And so I think that's the most overwhelming memory of popsicles and ice cream and whatever it was after dinner and then watching TV with my parents.
Tell me about your mom, and was she a good cook?
Yeah, she was a relatively good cook when she was younger. It got worse as she got older because she got into macrobiotics, and that was just brutal.
Oh, wait, macrobiotics. So what was she serving, like brown rice every meal?
Hard rocks.
Oh, no.
I'll never forget, in college, she sent me a cake for my birthday. And she, you know, our family wasn't big on holidays or birthdays. It was just really simple stuff. And she decided to go big time and make me a cake and have it ship FedEx or whatever to me. And I pulled it out and I have my buddies here. I'm like, let's taste this cake. And had a little note, hey, you know, this is healthy for you, so eat up. Oh my God, my buddies still give me a hard time about that. It was disgusting. And you got to realize, like, I don't even know how old I was. When I finally did the math, my mom was only 20 when I was born and just had turned 20. And she's just my mom. You don't think about it when you're young. So we ate what she could make. And but my dad, I think I remember more in what he would eat because he used to make these salads. He'd get a big bowl and he'd put in lettuce and he'd put in all the things he likes and he'd mix ketchup and mayonnaise to make his version of Russian dressing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it was great. And he would eat a whole bowl and I do the exact same thing. I do the exact same thing. And the funny thing is,
you do
this
today. You still do this.
I do this today. I do it all the time, two or three times a week. I just take pre-bagged lettuce. I put all the stuff I like to put in it. And then I'll either put some light ranch dressing, or this sounds crazy, but honey brown mustard I'll use as the dressing because it's sweet, tasty, not a lot of calories. And I'll mix it all together. And my kids, as they got older, were like, Dad, that's disgusting, da-da-da-da-da. And, you know, then I'm like, but you got to understand the golden rule of food. The golden rule of food is if you like one thing and you like another thing, and if you mix them together, it's going to be amazing. And I live by that rule. And they just get disgusted. Like, why are you putting... Yeah, so from my father, I picked that up. And my kids now rue the day that I gave them that rule. But if you like one thing and you like another thing and you mix them together, it's going to be amazing.
That's a pretty good rule. That's a pretty good rule. So I want to hear more about your mom, but I think I want to skip past reaching backward the macrobiotic experimental period and maybe go to that period when she was
cooking food that you really liked and got excited
right.
about.
Yeah. At that point in time, it was just the stuff that she learned from her mom.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So there was a lot of Jewish type foods from borscht to, which actually I liked a little bit, which in hindsight, I don't like anymore.
Cabbage soup.
Yeah. Cabbage soup, stuffed cabbage, noodle kugel. That was one of my favorites. Baked potatoes was stuffed with everything. Cabbage and coleslaw and lox. Bagels. I mean, that was a big Sunday experience for us, going with my dad to go pick up some lox and bagels at Weinstein's Bakery, which was a big deal in Pittsburgh at that point in time. Creamed herring, which he loved, which I thought was disgusting, but I came to like a little bit, and then I decided it was disgusting. You know, your taste. Oh, and
it's like pickled fish. For people who don't know it, it's pickled fish and sort of this creamy dill
creamy
kind of sauce.
Yes. Yes. And then chopped liver, which I loved. And my kids like look at me like I'm insane. My wife made me promise never to bring it into the house again.
Really? She doesn't like chopped liver?
Oh, she hates because of the smell. She just can't deal with the smell.
But chopped liver, with a little
awesome.
Chopped onions and cape. Yeah, that's good
yes,
stuff.
Yes, it is awesome. And so, you know, those are the things that I grew up with in my childhood that you can't help, but every time I see them, it just brings me back.
There's a great story I read about where you were lacking confidence at one point. And you asked, or I don't know if you asked or if your mom asked, but there's this great, I have the picture in my head and I'd love for you to describe it, where your mom is teaching you how to dance.
Yeah, I was about 12. To draw you a picture of me, I was shorter than I am now and weighed more than I do now. I had caps on my front two teeth, but they weren't the color of my other teeth. They were aluminum caps because that's what my parents could afford. So every time I smiled, if there was a reflection, people used to cover their eyes. I had glasses. Yeah, it wasn't like I was this big, confident guy, right, that was in the cool kids at school. Definitely not. But my mom and my dad liked to dance. I remember it vividly. They would dance in the house and they would go and they would take us sometimes to where they were dancing. And my mom decided she's going to teach me the box step. And she did. One, two, side, two, forward, two, side, two, back, two, you know. But when it came time to dance, I don't know if I ever used the box step per se, but it gave me rhythm. Like my dad had great rhythm and my mom had good rhythm too. And so I think they really enjoyed music and dancing. And as I started to mature and grow into my body and get taller and thinner, that paid off big dividends for me.
What were you listening to when you were dancing?
Back then, Tom Jones. My mom was Tom Jones. It's not unusual to be loved by it. I can name you the words to all the songs by Tom Jones.
Oh, yeah, the ladies in that time, they loved them some Tom Jones.
Tom Jones. Yeah,
the way
and my dad was more jazz.
Move those hips around and yeah.
They, oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. My mom was into Tom Jones also. Were you in the kitchen when you were dancing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, just wherever. I remember being in the kitchen because my mom smoked when I was young and just trying to steal her cigarettes and hide them and getting her mad. She'd be in the kitchen when I'd get home from school and I'd try singing or putting on music or whatever in the kitchen because back then it wasn't unusual for people to smoke. It wasn't unusual for them to smoke in a kitchen and to have a cigarette in your mouth while you were cooking. And fortunately, she stopped smoking, you know, a few years later. But yeah, vivid memories of that. And, you know, the other side of it was our kitchen looked out into the backyard. And that's where me and my brothers and my friends would always hang out. And so, you know, you're playing with your friends. And she'd walk out on the porch, Mark, time to come home. Or Mark, Brian, and Jeff, come on, let's go. It's dinner time. Stuff, you know, that seems stereotypical for the period, but is just really, really cool when you think about it.
So I've been to Pittsburgh before. It is a city of fiefdoms and a city of bridges.
Yep.
Hills and valleys and bridges connect all of it. And it sounds like you were crossing a lot of those bridges as you moved from one neighborhood to another neighborhood to another neighborhood in search of stability and better schooling. How has that affected you today as a leader, as a businessman? And what did you learn about your parents as they were crossing those bridges to go to work and then taking you as a family to get to new neighborhoods and better opportunities?
You know, it's a fascinating and great question because, You know, literally, we would cross bridges as we'd go visit my grandparents who stayed in Squirrel Hill. And at that point in time, the steel mills were everything. And I vividly remember driving to see them and the whole place smelling like rotten eggs. And I knew when I was getting close to my grandparents' house because I could smell it. And then there were so many other different elements that went into my childhood connecting to my grandparents, which gave me probably the greatest sense of my identity. Neither one of my parents went to college. My dad did upholstery, as I said, but just worked all kinds of hours. And I got to be close to my grandparents. I would literally would take the 41B bus from out front of my house from the time I was 13, 14 years old down through to Squirrel Hill to go visit them. And I always put an emphasis on, you know, having them tell me stories about the old world as much as they could, and between Yiddish and, you know, messed up English, you know, trying to convey to me the lives they lived. And it really was like listening to an original script reading of Fiddler on the Roof. Hmm. That was my identity growing up.
What did you learn from that, and what kind of imprint did that leave on you?
Oh, it's huge. My parents were kids of the Depression, particularly my dad, who's, you know, a couple years older than my mom, and listening to his stories about having to work a paper route and then going to school and then having to work another job in an ice cream factory and different things just to help his parents. Hearing the stories about my grandfather's on my dad's side, jobs as a waiter for a long time in a relatively nice restaurant, and then deciding to start his own grocery store. And it going well until Kristallnacht hit in 1938, and it got broken into and burned down and torn apart. And so that definitely starts to define your identity, mine as a Jew and just as a person, because nothing was ever taken for granted and the best was yet to come. And I think that was a big part of what has driven me as a person, because my grandparents came over with nothing, not speaking the language, you know, Yiddish and anything else. And they just got whatever jobs they could, lived with whoever they could, moved around, and they wanted better for their sons. And my dad, like I said, didn't go to college, but enlisted in the Navy, actually was in the Seabees. And, you know, I heard story after story there. So it's just all these things just define me, because my parents just wanted better for me and their parents wanted better for them. And it was always, okay, Mark, you're not going to be us. We'll do everything that we can to put you and my younger brothers, Brian and Jeff, with a better life. And, you know, I have stuff around my house and, you know, genealogy reports that I subscribe to just to be reminded of it every week.
Every so often in this podcast, I hear something from someone that I want to put on a tapestry pillow or something, have it embroidered on a pillow or affix it to the wall in some kind of poster. And you just said, nothing is taken for granted. The best is yet to come. Yeah. That's a pretty good mantra for life.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, we question that all the time. I think every generation does, but not my grandparents' generation and not my parents' generation, because we didn't have a lot. We weren't poor, but we didn't have a lot. But my dad had nothing. And his parents had less. And my mom was in the same situation. My grandfather on my mom's side was a schmutz salesperson. He had a briefcase and he would have samples of pants and shirts. And he literally, on the same street my dad worked on, he would literally start at the bottom of the hill and work his way up and go building to building to building, car dealership to car dealership to car dealership, selling whatever he could sell to make whatever money he could make. And again, working all hours. My grandmother, my mom's side, his wife, didn't really work. She had all kinds of issues, physical issues. And so he was a grinder in every sense of the word. And I just remember sitting with him and listening to him tell stories. And what we like to do, he liked to like turn cards and see how fast I can multiply them or add them and challenge me. And again, the whole element being, we don't want you to go through what we've gone through. It's really crazy when I think back on it. The people I would spend time with had to flee because of their religion or they would die. And their children, my parents, didn't have the benefit of anything. You know, my grandparents weren't in a position to do anything for them. And, you know, they were able to put together a middle-class life and put me in a house that they couldn't afford, to put me in a school district that they wanted me to be in, and the rest is history.
Sounds like you marched to your own drum in lots of ways.
Yeah.
And you were describing your uncle, and I don't speak Yiddish, so I'm probably going to not say this right, but you said he was a schmutzah salesman? Was I close?
No, my grandfather was a schmutzah, clothing sales.
And it sounds like you must have watched carefully because, again, in reading about you, you were selling all kinds of things at an early
age. Everything. Yeah, everything I could.
What was that about?
You know, my dad was always really clear. If you want something, you're going to have to earn that money yourself. There's things I can afford and things I can't afford. If I took a shower too long, my dad would be like, bam, 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 on the door. You know, come on, we're not heating everything. Or someone left a door open in the summer. We're not trying to air condition the entire neighborhood. Close the door. It was just how we were, right? It's just the way it was.
So what did you start selling? You were selling just about everything.
Well, I started with garbage bags, door to door. And so my dad and his buddies were playing poker. They played all the time on Thursday nights. And I'd walk in, say hi, grab a donut because they'd have donuts there. I remember asking my dad for a new pair of basketball shoes because then, like now, I was really into basketball. And he looks at me, he goes, "You see those shoes on your feet? They work. And if you want something, you know, when you get a job and you can afford to buy them, go for it." And I'm like, "Dad, I'm 12. How am I going to get a job?" And then one of his buddies, who was probably plastered because they all got plastered when they were playing poker, he was like, "I got something you can sell. I've got these boxes of garbage bags, 100 garbage bags in a box." And I'll never forget them because they weren't great garbage bags now in hindsight, but they were 100 garbage bags in a box. My cost was $3 and I sold them for $6. And I would go down the street. This is when we lived in Birdland on Metal Arc. And I'd go to our neighbors and be like, "Hi, my name is Mark. Do you use garbage bags?" And it was the easiest sale ever. I mean, who's going to say no to a 12-year-old kid? Somebody who needs garbage bags for $6, you deliver them. You don't have to carry them. So it was an easy sale. And that gave me a ton of confidence to be able to sell.
And what did you do with your profits?
I don't remember. I wish I did.
And you graduated from selling garbage bags to what?
Oh my goodness, you name it. I sold magazines door to door, another great experience. Sold candy with a crew of kids going door to door. I worked as a stocking clerk in a pharmacy. That wasn't sales. That got me through high school. And I bought and sold stamps too. So I became a stamp collector and I learned a lot about markets then. I would go to these stamp shows and I would go with 50 cents, a dollar, and I'd find a stamp that I knew was valuable because I would study all the values of all these different American stamps. I'll go to like one booth and look through the stamps, see what they got, realize somebody misidentified a stamp, take it to another stamp dealer somewhere else and show him why this was the right stamp identification and sell it for more. And I, you know, I'd made over the course of a school year, $50, $100, which for a 15, 16-year-old kid is pretty good.
Well, it sounds like you were very good at sales. And at some point you decided, enough with high school. I'm going to night school. And you enrolled in college early.
Yeah. So my junior year of high school at Mount Lebanon High School, I asked if I could take the economics class that was only for seniors. And they said, no. I said, well, that's insane, right? I'm trying to challenge myself and da-da-da-da, me challenging the bureaucracy. And so I said, you know, I'm going to prove to you that I'm smart enough to do these things and prove to myself, actually. So I registered for a psychology class at the University of Pittsburgh. And I also registered for a graduate level class in Russian education. I'm like, I don't know. I'm going to challenge myself. I'll see how smart I really am. And I didn't last a week in that class. But the psychology class, I did well. And then I said, well, okay, now I can go to the University of Pittsburgh. I'm not going back to high school. And so I went to Pitt for what would have been my senior year of high school.
And everything transferred? I mean, you didn't have to like do the college essay. You didn't have to fill out all those forms or anything. You just kind of took yourself to college in an interesting way.
Well, yeah, because once I took the night classes, I was enrolled, right? So I just enrolled for more classes. But to get to Indiana after Pitt, yeah, I had to go through all that. But that's a whole nother story.
And how did you get to Indiana?
Pitt didn't have an undergraduate business school. And so while I spent the 1 year at Pitt, it was just taking basic classes and I wasn't very serious about it, honestly. But business was still my mission and where I wanted to do. And I saw a list of the top 10 business schools and I read The Insider's Guide to Partying, and Indiana was a top 10 undergrad business school and top three in partying. So I'm like, that's the combo I need. Out of that top 10 of business schools, I picked out the cheapest one. It was Indiana. And I applied, got in, and showed up on campus my freshman year there, sight unseen.
So that's an interesting equation. Top business school, big party campus at University of Indiana. How much partying did you actually do? Did you change your ways and focus primarily on business, or did you figure out how to balance both those things?
My first 2 years, I decided I was going to reinvent myself. I lived on this dorm room, B109 in Foster Quad, Indiana University, ran for floor president. This was going to be the new Mark Cuban and won. And so for the first semester, I was the floor president. But I also decided that even though I drank when I was at the University of Pittsburgh, I'm like, okay, I'm not going to drink my freshman and hopefully my sophomore year because I'm going to take hard classes. I'm going to do everything back-ass halfwards. I'm going to take the hardest classes I can my freshman and sophomore year, what would be my junior and senior classes. And then my actual junior and senior year, I'm going to take the freshman classes because they'll be easier and I can party like a rock star. And that's what I did.
And did that work out?
It worked out great. you know, and the
young people take note.
Right. And to continue the story, back then you didn't register. It wasn't a digital registration. You would have these computer cards and you'd stand in line to register for a class. And I was getting ready to register for my hard classes, but there was a line there for MBA graduate level statistics, K501. And I stood in line. And they didn't challenge me. I got into the class, took the class, graduate level statistics, and got an A in it. And I'm like, okay, this is an MBA class, statistics? Are you kidding me? I just got an A in it? This stuff's going to be easy.
Now, an observation. You have amazing recall for numbers. Course K501, dorm number B109, 1223 Bower Hill Road, 1134 Meadowlark Drive. You remember all this. I'm going to have to go play the numbers when I leave here and go buy a lotto ticket with some of these numbers. Have you always had a head for numbers?
Yeah. It's always been really easy for me. On Shark Tank, Barbara Corcoran just like calls me the human computer. And so she can't do math at all. So when she sits next to me, I do all of her math for her. It's not that I'm great at math. It's just that I process things really quickly.
Like most people, our family struggles to find time to manage finances. At the end of a busy week, the last thing we want to do is spend time budgeting all of our expenses and tracking down customer service teams to cancel old subscriptions that we no longer use. But we discovered Rocket Money does all of that. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. With Rocket Money, you have full control over your subscriptions and a clear view of your expenses. You can see all of your subscriptions in one place, and you can see if there's something that you don't want anymore. Rocket Money can help you cancel with just a few taps. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate to lower your bills by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They will deal with customer service for you. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and it has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/kitchen. That's rocketmoney.com/kitchen. rocketmoney.com/kitchen.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. I love to be able to cook in a kitchen and have a good meal with the people I care about all around me. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen and a big island, and we were able to all get in and do our thing together and sit down in the adjoining dining room and have a long, loud meal and then clean up afterwards and continue the conversation. I loved being able to do that, and Airbnb allowed that to happen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. Hosting your home on Airbnb is a great way to make some extra money. It's very practical as a side hustle. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I read a lot about you in preparation for this interview.
Sorry.
And your mom, no, I loved it. I love getting to know you. Your mom sounds like a very special person. And it sounds like a lot of the confidence that we see in your ownership of the Mavericks, in your role in Shark Tank, in your leadership throughout all the things that you do, it seems like a lot of that came from your mom.
It really did. It really, really did. More my mom than my dad. My mom taught me to question everything. And my mom taught me that when you challenge things, there's going to be consequences. But as long as you know they're coming, then that's the way it goes. I mean, with teachers, I remember, I don't like this teacher because da-da-da-da-da. She's like, Mark, they've got the pen and the paper and the grade book. You better be willing to accept the consequences if you're going to challenge them. And I did. And I remember her reading me stories even when I was younger and me driving her crazy with the why, and her not flinching. It's okay to ask why. I remember when I was in high school, I decided to wear a shirt that said bullshit on it. And she's like, you're going to get suspended. I'm like, yeah, maybe, but it'll be fun. I didn't make it for an hour.
You were back home again?
Sent home. Yeah, that was back home. She taught me to test boundaries. And I think that that's really been important to me. And both my parents, again, because they didn't go to college, they didn't really have an education then. It was like, go do what you're doing. Don't be afraid to fail. Don't worry if things don't go exactly the way you want initially, because what's the worst thing that can happen? What have you got to lose? And, you know, when you got nothing to lose, there's only one direction you can go.
That's some special parenting, though, because many parents would say, get back upstairs and take that T-shirt off. But your mom let you go because she thought, well, he's going to have to figure this out for himself. And you learned the lesson.
Yep. You're going to have to deal with the consequences.
You seem to see yourself as a bit of an outsider. And I wonder if there's some benefit to that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you had to move lots of times. You were always a new kid. You went from being in a Jewish community to being one of only two families. I think about that in the way that you run your own business. When we were talking as we got started, we noted that we have a friend in common, your GM, Sint Marshall, who's an African-American woman. Aren't a lot of those running things in the NBA.
Nope.
When you are an outsider, is it easier to reach outside to look for talent?
Yeah, for sure.
Is it easier to reach outside to look for new thinking and new pathways?
Absolutely, positively, because you know, the system never worked for me. And the system doesn't work for a lot of people. But some people are forced to work within the system and find their answers and their whatever it is they need there. And some of us thrive by working outside the system, knowing that when everybody's doing it the same way, the greatest opportunities come outside that. And you can find the nuggets that other people never look for. Whenever I started something that was disruptive or new, it was always because this was the habits they were in. And if you just look a little bit closer and look on the outside, like what are the things we can do to accomplish what we need to accomplish without first thinking, here's the way it's supposed to be done. And whenever I hear somebody say, here's the way it's supposed to be done, I already know that's the wrong way to do it. Now, that's got me in trouble working in jobs, but it's worked out for me as an entrepreneur.
What do you do in your household now with your kids, in your home, particularly in your kitchen, to honor your family and especially your mother?
Not as much as we probably should, because that's my wife's area. And my kids prefer it that way.
No, you don't cook.
No, I don't cook except for myself. And my wife, I'm like, baby, if you make something in the microwave, that's cooking. She's like, that's not cooking. If you're using a microwave, that is not cooking. And, you know, we just laugh and argue about it. And my kids are like, no, Dad, that's not cooking. Stay away. And so my wife typically makes the stuff for herself and the kids. And because I'm vegetarian and they're young and growing, we tend to eat differently, except if she happens to make something that just by chance is vegetarian.
When did you become a vegetarian?
About 4 years ago. And the why, as you get older, my body's an orthopedic mess. I mean, both hips replaced, you know, herniated disc, torn rotator cuffs. And so in the morning, I'd be sore. And I still try to work out and compete and all that kind of stuff, play basketball, lift. And I read up, and everywhere I read about being a vegetarian, it was good for reducing inflammation in my body. I tried it, and I felt better, so I've stuck with it. And look, I cheat, definitely, because if we're out to dinner and there's nothing vegetarian, I'll eat fish or whatever. So I guess you can say, by definition, I'm a pescatarian, but for the most part, I stick to being a vegetarian.
You're a flexitarian.
A flexitarian. Yeah, but I try to stick to it because it's better for my health.
Did you ever try the macrobiotic diet that your mother introduced at some point?
Hell no. I was so scarred off of that. So scarred. Just the word macro, this is no lie, the word macrobiotics. Whenever it comes up, I get the heebie-jeebies.
It was that bad?
It was horrible. I mean, I can feel how hard that cake was and how awful, and the sound of my buddies laughing at me.
And especially when it's a care package, because when you're in college and you get a care package, you're so excited that you might get a taste of home.
I mean, how can you even mess up the icing?
Oh, no. I'm surprised there was icing.
No, there was icing, was just awful. And literally, I'd have to say, no, Mom, you know, go back to the old basics if you're going to send me something.
So when you get a craving for a taste of home now, at this point in your life, what is that? What's a recipe that is really special to you that makes you think of the old days back in Pittsburgh?
Noodle kugel, for sure. That's my go-to. That's literally after my mom's macrobiotic phase. I was like, if you're going to send me anything, please send me some of your noodle kugel, raisin noodle kugel. That was my all-time favorite then. It's my all-time favorite now. That's my go-to.
What's special about it?
I mean, just the memories. Then the taste brings back a flood of amazing family memories. And again, racing my brothers to see who can get the biggest squares of the kugel. And the best part of raisin noodle kugel is the edges, because the edges are a little bit burned and, you know, that's where all the flavor comes from. And so just that is everything.
Was that a weeknight dish or was that a special?
No, that was a special, right? Because that meant my mom really had to cook. And, it takes a couple hours or whatever to cook. And so you could smell it the whole day. And we'd push her to put more raisins in there and some cinnamon on it sometimes. So, yeah, it was a special event.
You know, kugel is not just a dish. It's kind of like a genre or a category because it's so different depending on who's making it. How did your mom make it?
The old-fashioned Jewish way. Yeah, regular noodles. It means raisins.
Egg noodles?
Yeah, egg noodles, yeah. Egg noodles, raisins, hopefully cinnamon, eggs, butter, tons of butter, and just mixing it all together and putting it together and then baking it for however long she needed to and then just smelling it on its way out and then just having to push my brother, since they were younger and smaller, away so I could get the most of it. And then at times putting ice cream on it if we had vanilla ice cream and making the combo work.
And served warm usually?
Oh, yeah. It's got to be warm. Melting the ice cream and it's soft and it's sweet and it doesn't feel like a noodle dish, right? It feels more like a cake. It's just, yeah, it was something special.
So do you ever go back to Squirrel Hill now, ever get back to Pittsburgh? I just wonder what your family thinks. They must be tremendously proud.
My high school friends, a couple of them live there now. And so my high school friends are still my best friends. And so going back to see them and Zooming with them all the time, yeah, I will go back and go to the JCC, the Jewish Community Center, and shoot hoops still, taking a walk on Forbes Avenue, Murray Avenue. I took my kids and took the whole family there 3 years ago and had them walk by Carnegie Mellon and in Shadyside and by Schenley Park. And it was too many hills for them, but it was old home for me.
Pittsburgh is a hilly city. You want to wear comfortable shoes when you go there. Mark Cuban, I have loved talking to you. This has been a lot of fun.
This has really been fun. I appreciate the questions. You really made me think about things I haven't thought of in a long, long time. So thanks.
That's great. That's what we try to do. We have to get the recipe for the noodle kugel so we can share that with our listeners. That's hard to say. Noodle kugel. Say that fast.
Noodle
five
kugel.
Times
yeah,
in a row.
Right. That's probably put the raisin in there. Noodle raisin kugel.
Okay, that makes it easier. Noodle raisin kugel. We'll get the recipe and we will share it with our listeners. All the best to you.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
What a storyteller. Mark Cuban's story is inspiring and entertaining. His optimism is contagious. You can see how he moves people from skepticism to enthusiasm. And knowing where he came from, it's easier to understand how he sees the world and tries to seize opportunities to create new ways of doing things. Mark's family taught him to take nothing for granted, that hard work, taking chances, and an open mind can pay dividends, and that true confidence comes not from what you own, but from who you are deep down inside. I don't think I will ever forget the picture of a young Mark Cuban with the silver caps on his teeth, learning how to dance from his mother, knowing that one day he would step into some space somewhere and impress everybody. He sure did that. I so enjoyed getting to know Mark better in our conversation, and I'm really looking forward to getting to know his mother's noodle raisin kugel because I plan to try this out in my kitchen. We will share that recipe with you on our website, yourmamaskitchen.com, and on my Instagram at Michelle_Norris. That's 2 underscores between Michelle and Norris. And we're not done yet. We want to hear from you. We're opening up our inbox for you to record yourself and tell us about your mama's recipes, some memories from your kitchen growing up. We want to hear about your mama's kitchens. So make sure to send us a voice memo at ymk@highergroundproductions.com for
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Chance to be featured in a future episode. Thanks again to Mark Cuban. Thanks to all of you for joining us. Make sure you come back next week. And until then, be bountiful. This has been a Higher Ground and Audible original produced by Higher Ground Studios. Senior producer, Natalie Wren. Producer, Sonia Tun. Additional production support by Misha Jones. Sound design and engineering from Andrew Epen and Ryan Kozlowski. Higher Ground Audio's editorial assistant is Camilla Thurdikus. Executive producers for Higher Ground are Nick White, Mukta Mohan, Dan Fearman, and me, Michelle Norris. Executive producers for Audible are Nick D'Angelo and Ann Hepperman. The show's closing song is is 504 by the Soul Rebels. Editorial and web support from Melissa Baer and Say What Media, talent booker Angela Peluso. Special thanks this week to Clean Cuts in Washington, D.C., and Luminous Sound in Dallas, Texas. Chief Content Officer for Audible, Rachel Giazza. And that's it. Bye, everybody.
Copyright 2023 by Higher Ground Audio, LLC. Sound recording copyright 2023 by Higher Ground Audio, LLC.